readings around mindfulness of the body. I'm going to I'm going to read as much of from the Kayagatasati Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 119, as it seems reasonable in this bit of time. I probably will end up skipping some of the parts of it just because it's a bit long. And I'm choosing to read from this one rather than straight from the Satipatthana on the mindfulness of the body, just to show a slight different emphasis, although a lot of it's overlapping and much of it's the same in this particular section. There does seem to be a slightly different emphasis in that when one engages in contemplation of the body, mindfulness of the body practice, there's different things that one can experience from that, different benefits that one can experience from contemplation of the body. And one of them is just a general calming and stilling and cooling of the mind, settling of the mind. Another is settling of more of the attachment to sensual desire, sort of the asubha practice, settling the extremes of passion. And then also developing insight is kind of another angle. And in the Satipatthana Sutta itself, you can see how, I mean, all of them, of course, take place in both suttas, but with the refrain that Lumpa has been talking about quite a bit, you can see that there's a strong emphasis on the development of insight, the arising and passing, the internal, the external qualities, and then just seeing the body and the other foundations of mindfulness, but in this particular case, the body, just in and of itself as a non-personal process. And that comes back over and over again in the Satipatthana, in the refrain that Lumpa has been talking about quite a bit. So in the Kayagatasati Sutta, the mindfulness of the body, the major difference in the first set of passages is that refrain, that same refrain, doesn't exist in this one, but is replaced with a different one, which kind of points a little more towards the calming or development of concentration aspect of contemplation of the body. And then following the different sections of contemplation of the body, it goes into a description of some beautiful descriptions of the four jhanas that I'm sure most people are familiar with, but it's always nice to hear them read out again and just use them as a contemplation as they're being read out. So I thought I'd just go ahead and get started with the Mindfulness of the Body Sutta, again, abbreviating it and not reading all the introductory parts, those kinds of things. Just to give us an overview of the different aspects of the actual contemplations themselves. And then after the one pra tomorrow and the day after, then launch a bit more into detail on some of them, particularly the contemplation of the 32 parts of the body. There's been a request, and I thought it would be good timing to sort of do a reprise of the slideshow that Ajahn Yatiko and I did a few years ago in different settings. And so after the one pra, we'll spend probably a couple of days just going over those and kind of looking at them, getting them set in the mind, reestablishing the visual images of the 32 parts, and offering some thoughts as to how to use it in our practice in a skillful way. It's also just a little bit hard sometimes with some of the contemplations of the body to maintain a sense of balance about it. It tends to be, particularly along the 32 parts in the cemetery contemplation, not something that is really popular among the non-monastic world. But there's sort of a growing secret society of lay people, too, who are interested in it. It sometimes is seen as quite life-denying, I think, in some ways. But if it's used properly, it is really a very, very powerful practice, and not one that actually develops aversion, which is what some people feel. So keeping that in mind as we go through all of these, I'll just go ahead and get started with the Kaya Gata Sati Sutta. Here a bhikkhu, gone to the forest, or to the root of a tree, or to an empty hut, sits down. Having folded his legs crosswise, set his body erect, and established mindfulness in front of him, ever mindful he breathes in, mindful he breathes out. Breathing in long, he understands, I breathe in long. Or breathing out long, he understands, I breathe out long. Breathing in short, he understands, I breathe in short. Or breathing out short, he understands, I breathe out short. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, experiencing the whole body. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, experiencing the whole body. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the bodily formation. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the bodily formation. And this is where it branches from the Satipatthana, and this is the refrain that I'm about to read is the one that will appear repetitively throughout this particular sutta instead of the one more geared towards insight. As he abides thus diligent, ardent, and resolute, his memories and intentions based on the household life are abandoned. With their abandoning, his mind becomes steadied, internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. This is how a bhikkhu develops mindfulness of the body. I'll pause right there for a minute to say that, at least in the next few days, I'm probably not going to talk a lot about Anapanasati, although that's clearly one of the key contemplations in mindfulness of the body. It could be a whole retreat in itself in some ways, if one particularly used the Anapanasati Sutta as a basis. And I think because of that, I won't put a lot of emphasis on it right now. Perhaps also Lung Paul might grace us with some of his teachings on Anapanasati. That's kind of the king here of Anapanasati. The four postures. Again, bhikkhus, when walking, a bhikkhu understands, I am walking. When standing, he understands, I am standing. When sitting, he understands, I am sitting. When lying down, he understands, I am lying down. Or he understands accordingly, however his body is disposed. As he abides thus diligent, ardent, and resolute, his memories and intentions based on the household life are abandoned. And with their abandoning, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. That too is how a bhikkhu develops mindfulness of the body. Full awareness. Again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu is one who acts in full awareness when going forward and returning, who acts in full awareness when looking ahead and looking away, who acts in full awareness when flexing and extending his limbs, who acts in full awareness when wearing his robes and carrying his outer robe and bowl, who acts in full awareness when eating, drinking, consuming food, and tasting, who acts in full awareness when defecating or urinating, who acts in full awareness when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and keeping silent. As he abides thus diligent, ardent, and resolute, his memories and intentions based on the household life are abandoned. That too is how a bhikkhu develops mindfulness of the body. The body parts. Again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu reviews this same body up from the soles of the feet and down from the top of the hair, bounded by skin, as full of many kinds of impurity thus. In this body there are head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, intestines, mesentery, contents of the stomach, feces, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spittle, snot, oil of the joints, and urine. Just as though there were a bag with an opening at both ends full of many sorts of grain, such as hill rice, red rice, beans, peas, millet, and white rice, and a man with good eyes were to open it and review it thus. This is hill rice. This is red rice. These are beans. These are peas. This is millet. This is white rice. So, too, a bhikkhu reviews the same body as full of many kinds of impurity thus. In this body there are head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, intestines, mesentery, contents of the stomach, feces, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spittle, snot, oil of the joints, and urine. As he abides thus diligent, ardent, and resolute, his memories and intentions based on the household life are abandoned. That, too, is how a bhikkhu develops mindfulness of the body. Next section on elements. Again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu reviews this same body, however it is placed, however disposed, as consisting of elements thus. In this body there are the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. Just as though a skilled butcher or his apprentice had killed a cow and were seated at the crossroads with it cut up into pieces, so, too, a bhikkhu reviews this same body, however it is placed, however disposed, as consisting of elements thus. In this body there are the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. As he abides thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, his memories and intentions connected with the household life are abandoned. That, too, is how a bhikkhu develops mindfulness of the body. The nine charnel ground contemplations. Again, bhikkhus, as though he were to see a corpse thrown aside in a charnel ground, 1, 2, or 3 days dead, bloated, livid, and oozing matter. A bhikkhu compares this same body with it thus. This body, too, is of the same nature. It will be like that. It is not exempt from that fate. As he abides thus diligent, that, too, is how a bhikkhu develops mindfulness of the body. Again, as though he were to see a corpse thrown aside in a charnel ground, being devoured by crows, hawks, vultures, dogs, jackals, or various kinds of worms. A bhikkhu compares this same body with it thus. This body, too, is of the same nature. It will be like that. It is not exempt from that fate. As he abides thus diligent, that, too, is how a bhikkhu develops mindfulness of the body. Again, as though he were to see a corpse thrown aside in a charnel ground, a skeleton with flesh and blood, held together with sinews. A fleshless skeleton smeared with blood, held together with sinews. A skeleton without flesh and blood, held together with sinews. Disconnected bones scattered in all directions. Here a hand bone, there a foot bone, here a shin bone, there a thigh bone, here a hip bone, there a backbone, here a rib bone, there a breast bone, here an arm bone, there a shoulder bone, here a neck bone, there a jaw bone, here a tooth, there the skull. A bhikkhu compares this same body with it thus. This body, too, is of the same nature. It will be like that. It is not exempt from that fate. As he abides thus diligent, that, too, is how a bhikkhu develops mindfulness of the body.
Again, as though he were to see a corpse thrown aside in a charnel ground, bones bleached white, the color of shells, bones heaped up, bones more than a year old, rotted and crumbled to dust. A bhikkhu compares the same body with it thus. This body, too, is of the same nature. It will be like that. It is not exempt from that fate. As he abides thus diligent, ardent and resolute, his memories and intentions based on the household life are abandoned. With their abandoning, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. That is how a bhikkhu develops mindfulness of the body. So those are the categories of contemplation attributed to the mindfulness of the body section here. And as I said, going into some more details on each of those. Now here is the section on the development of the jhanas based on contemplation of the body. Again, bhikkhus, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. He makes the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Just as a skilled bathman or bathman's apprentice heaps bath powder in a metal basin and, sprinkling it gradually with water, kneads it till the moisture wets his ball of bath powder, soaks it and pervades it inside and out, yet the ball itself does not ooze. So too a bhikkhu makes the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body, so that there is no part of this whole body unpervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. As he abides thus diligent, that too is how a bhikkhu develops mindfulness of the body. Again, bhikkhus, with the stilling of applied and sustained thought, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the second jhana, which has self-confidence and singleness of mind, without applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of concentration. He makes the rapture and pleasure born of concentration drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of concentration. Just as though there were a lake whose waters welled up from below, and it had no inflow from east, west, north, or south, and would not be replenished from time to time by showers of rain, then the cool font of water welling up in the lake would make the cool water drench, steep, fill, and pervade the lake, so that there would be no part of the whole lake unpervaded by cool water. So too, a bhikkhu makes the rapture and pleasure born of concentration drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of concentration. As he abides thus diligent, that too is how a bhikkhu develops mindfulness of the body. Again, bhikkhus, with the fading away as well of rapture, a bhikkhu abides in equanimity, and mindful and fully aware, still feeling pleasure with the body, he enters upon and abides in the third jhana, on account of which noble ones announce, he has a pleasant abiding who has equanimity and is mindful. He makes the pleasure divested of rapture drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the pleasure divested of rapture. Just as in a pond of blue or white or red lotuses, some lotuses that are born and grow in the water thrive immersed in the water without rising out of it, and cool water drenches, steeps, fills, and pervades them to their tips and their roots, so that there is no part of all those lotuses unpervaded by cool water. So too, a bhikkhu makes the pleasure divested of rapture drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the pleasure divested of rapture. As he abides thus diligent, that too is how a bhikkhu develops mindfulness of the body. Again, bhikkhus, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure, and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. He sits pervading this body with a pure, bright mind, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the pure, bright mind. Just as though a man were sitting covered from head down with a white cloth, so that there would be no part of his body not covered by the white cloth, so too a bhikkhu sits pervading this body with a pure, bright mind, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the pure, bright mind. As he abides thus diligent, ardent, and resolute, his memories and intentions based on the household life are abandoned. With their abandoning, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. That, too, is how a bhikkhu develops mindfulness of the body. So the sutta continues on for a few more pages with some interesting reflections, but I think I'll stop it right there for the time being, because I just wanted to go back for a minute to the first couple of contemplations that come in right after the mindfulness of breathing section, just to make a few comments. The section on the four postures and full awareness, I just mentioned a few things about just that being aware of the disposition of the body, sitting, lying, walking, or standing, and then the full awareness where the person is aware of every activity, you know, extending limbs and walking and how they wear robes, falling asleep, waking up, consuming food, all of these kinds of things are, I think, really important aspects to bring into our awareness, because they're the kinds of activities that help us have a continuity of mindfulness throughout all of our day, throughout all of our activities. It's easy to compartmentalize some of these kinds of contemplations to when we're on the cushion. But, you know, when you think about it, we're not on the cushion all that many hours out of a 24-hour day. And I think these other reflections on the postures and acting in full awareness are really pointing to how this needs to be a continuous kind of practice as best we can. It's kind of using it in all activities, trying to, you know, use our effort to maintain this establishing of wholesome mind states using appropriate attention, like I was talking about yesterday. And that the sense of the body as it's doing its regular activities is the kind of the grounding or the basis for our attention. And it's also useful to know that, you know, one can be looking at the state of mind using the body as a grounding focus. Just knowing the state of mind also is really important. You're not totally consumed with only the body and shutting out any kind of other experience. I mean, there's a story that Ajahn Chah, I think I read somewhere, that he tells about a person that was washing dishes very mindfully and being very aware of, you know, the water and the dishes and all of the activities of the body that were going on. Going through the routine with that kind of strong focus. But the mind was totally filled with anger and aversion and thinking about somebody else who had done this person wrong and grumbling and complaining and feeling all sorts of anger. And that's obviously not being very mindful. There's sort of the appearance or the kind of the intention of being mindful of the body, but totally ignoring a very unskillful, unwholesome mind state and that suffering.
So this needs to be also used in context, in its greater context, and that's part of what clear awareness is all about. It's not just focusing so totally on one very narrow aspect that you're missing a completely unwholesome activity that's going on in the mind in another sphere there. So the whole aspect of the postures and the full awareness is one where you're keeping the center of focus in the body as a point of reference. And it's almost like I find it, and it's a word that Anayo brought up in his book, which is I think very descriptive. It's maintaining this sense of body awareness is like engaging the proprioceptive aspects of the body. So proprioception is really knowing the disposition of the body in time and space, and how it's moving and its presence and within its surroundings. And proprioception is dependent on a number of the sense experiences. It's dependent on just the tactile sensation of the body, feeling the body as it's moving through space and doing sorts of activities. But it's also dependent on visual cues to know where the body is in relation to other objects. It's dependent on hearing as a way of establishing a sense of location. So you can just even experience that now as we're sitting in the room, that your sense of where you are and what you're doing is dependent on the feeling in the body. It's dependent on any visual cues when your eyes are open, your place in the room. It's dependent on the sounds, whether it's the sound of my voice or outside sounds help to place the body and an awareness of the body in the right here and now, but aware of the context, aware of the location, where you are in time and space, and other subtle bodily aspects like the sense of balance from the inner ear that plays into the whole sense of body awareness in time and space. So it's an interesting thing to contemplate as you go through the day. How is it that you know where you are? You know, what is it that's feeding into that process of that awareness of what you're doing, where you are? It's many different kinds of inputs from the world around us, including our own body, but it takes attention and it takes remembering, mindfulness, memory, to bring that to our awareness. So I think I'll leave it there for the moment if there's any questions.
In the list there's a word that I'm not familiar with, mesentery. I could say it maybe was the entire mess.
Mess spelled differently. it's like the connective tissues, the internal tissues in the abdominal region. Also, maybe sometimes broader used, including, I think, you know, all other aspects of the abdominal cavity in a broader term, sometimes even referring to, I think, intestinal kinds of things, but I think more the connective tissue. Yeah.
Sometimes it gets translated as diaphragm.
Yeah, it's a different translation. Yeah, I think there's a conflict, because is that the one we use in our morning chanting as diaphragm? I can't remember what we use.
Membranes.
yeah, so there's different, they're not quite sure exactly what that one particular word is translated as.
I was curious about that. I looked a good bit about it, because the intestines, there's a lot of connective stuff for deliver or taking the nutrients, and so it's the blood vessels and the things that hold
all the stuff that hold it together.
So there's a lot of stuff there that digesting, how it gets it out of there, and also waste products, how they get in there.
Yeah. It's all integrated into the
question regarding that the list of parts, and like, for example, morning chanting, there's brain at the end, but there's also other parts that aren't listed, like eyes, or how much of eyes are listed, or
yeah, the sense organs are notably not in the list, all of the sense organs. Yeah, I think the brain came in as an addition later on from the original teachings. Was it in the commentaries?
The commentary.
Yeah, came in. So we added that one I'm not sure why it wasn't in the original list, but you'll notice, I mean, there's a lot of things that are missing. It's not just the sense organs. You know, there's no pancreas and no gallbladder and yeah, there's contents of the stomach, but there's not the stomach, you know, all those kinds. So there's lots that are missing. It's not meant to be like a complete anatomical list of body parts. It's more used just as a reflective tool to get a sense of the fact that there's a lot more, and we'll get into more of this next week when we really do the 32 parts, but that there's a lot that we're choosing not to see when, you know, we're bound up with, say, attraction, which is one of the reasons that we do this. Or if we're just bound up in the sense of body as self, from that aspect of it, there's a lot that we are kind of assuming when we impute a sense of self on the body. One way of trying to tease that whole sense of unity and me-ness with the body is by looking at its various components, breaking it down into its parts, and considering, you know, individually, is that me? Is that one me? Is that one me? What if, you know, what if I don't have that part? You know, that kind of a thing, to help to kind of deconstruct the sense of self around the body. So it's used for contemplation, but not so much as a, you know, an anatomical dictionary. Another good point, I think, along those lines, and you can see it, and we'll again talk more about it next week, is that the comparison that is used with the man looking at the sack of beans and rice, things like that, is just, it's not, again, the contemplation of the body is not to develop aversion, but it's to develop a sense of neutrality around the body. And so just as somebody looking in a sack of grains and seeing the different kinds of grains would just be noticing these different components that make it up, it's that same sense of, you know, seeing just what it is. What is just this body in its, you know, neutral sense that gives a sense of dispassion around it. So it's just kind of looking at it just in that light.
Also, body contemplation as a sankhya object reminds me a lot of, gosh, must have been 2 or 3 years ago during a winter retreat, somebody had given some readings from Ajahn Nan. And he had started out using, you know, also discussion yesterday about a lot of conceptualization around this, Aaron. And I just, in your readings today, I was reminded of how Ajahn Nan, if I recall correctly, started out with just going through the 32 parts and like conjuring it up in his mind. But then after a while, after going through the list a few times, one of those really stuck out to him. I believe it was hair. Mm-hmm. And hair arose as a nimitta. Mm-hmm. He proceeded to use the hair nimitta as
a concentration object.
Object. And, I mean, needless to say, he made much.
Yeah, that's a very common teaching in from the Thai Kruba Ajahns is you know, as a development of concentration, using the 32 parts as a development of concentration, often with letting finding one that particularly stands out for one, that speaks to one, and then honing in on that one and developing it as a meditation object for the development of concentration. It's not so much talked about in the suttas that I've seen in that way. It's more of a holistic, you know, just looking at the body in and of itself as it's kind of described here. But that's one that is talked a lot about in the Thai tradition.
I just have a minor, I guess, linguistic inquiry regarding the term impurity and foulness.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious about what the Pali root of that is, and because in my own contemplation, when I begin to ascribe parts of my body as impure, it can have the exact opposite of attraction to pull me into aversion and even a level of shame.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just wondering if, I know most Pali terms are hard to translate into English, and if there's a softer way to...
Well, I think asubha is the most common one where people are using it as foulness, and the root of asubha is suba, which means beautiful. Is just means not, so not beautiful. Yeah, the opposite of beautiful. So it has a very different connotation when it's translated as unattractive or not beautiful, as opposed to foul or
loathsome,
right? That's another one. And I think, you know, that's the way to me from, again, like, you know, the way that the teaching looks like in the books, particularly again with that comparison of looking at it like one looks at a bag of beans. You know, you don't look at rice and millet and grain as beautiful and attractive and, alluring. You just look at it as rice and beans and grains. And that's what seem the unbeautiful or unattractive aspects of the body. Because, you know, sensual desire itself is an exaggeration of reality. It's seeing things in an exaggerated way. Because, you know, to satisfy the sensual need or the desire for sensual pleasure, one has to specifically target those particular aspects of an object that one finds attractive and alluring, and specifically ignore the other parts that aren't. You know, if you want to maintain a sense of interest and desire and pleasure, you really have to be very selective about what you're looking at. So the teaching is to, you know, like wake up to reality. It's like just look at it just as it is and see the effect that it has on the mind, a very cooling, you know, balancing kind of effect. Not one, if it's moving towards aversion or disgust, it's being held in the wrong way. If it's moving towards neutrality and clarity, then it's being used in the right way. Yeah.
Is the asuchino?
Oh yeah, asuchino is the other, the one for impurity, I guess. Like in the introduction to the chant, asuchino. Suchino, I'm not sure. Pure, I guess.
That's what people would translate, like unclean or...
Yeah, I guess suchino is pure and then asuchino would be impure.
This is observational listening. You know, words also are, you know, it's similar in describing, you know, our perceptions can be so skewed, like, to see beautiful, but, like, words themselves, there's a lot of loadedness. Mm. So, like, I think words like impure, I mean, they come from a whole cultural baggage around, so just that word.
Right.
There's a huge amount coming with it, too.
Right, right. It's like, bad. This is bad. You are dirty, filthy creature. Right.
Impurity is like sinful.
Right. Right.
Yeah. I mean, just to point out that it was probably more intense association in Indian culture, especially the Brahmin notion thing, the caste system, all that is based around, like many cultures, purity and impurity, and so certain things like feces are tanners. Tanners were the lowest caste. In fact, they were outcasts because of the tan that was used and everything like that. So the whole structure and, you know, getting into like tantra and all that, like, the dynamics of purity and impurity pervade Indian, especially ancient Indian culture. Mm-hmm. It's very powerful.
It's like you get a hair in your soup, and it's that's kind of how I think about it.
One thing I found myself doing, just because I find sometimes when I'm doing the contemplation of the body parts, I get distracted about trying to remember where they are in the body, and it just like takes it off in a totally different direction. I find as a helpful contemplation for me trying to disassociate with the body as something that's mine is thinking about all of the different cells of the body, the hundreds of millions of cells, and they're all each individual little creatures. How could any one of them possibly be me? And I find that pretty helpful.
Yeah, that's very skillful. Great. Yeah, there's all sorts of ways that one can try and tease out that sense of self in relation to the body. So this is good preparation for a couple of days from now when we get the slideshow for those who want to. Okay, we'll call it a day. Annamaya magataya sadhu namase sadhu.